aware of whistleblowers whose lives are permanently changed when they make their revelations. Many head to prison. Many never work in their fields of expertise ever again. Many lose friends, family, and the respect of their peers. So why is it that some whistleblowers get the red carpet treatment? Why are some lauded by Congress and the media? We'll look at the double standard between whistleblowers who risk everything and people whom the media like to call whistleblowers, who are little more than corporate spokespeople or individuals hoping to make a political point. I'm John Kiriakou. You're watching The Whistleblowers. Frances Haugen was a Facebook data engineer and scientist. She appeared first on the American news program 60 Minutes, and then before a congressional committee on Capitol Hill to say that Facebook misled investors on how they handled hate speech, misinformation, teenage mental health, and violent content. Why did she go public with her revelations? Haugen said that she, quote, wanted to make Facebook the best company it can be, unquote. Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat from Connecticut, said that Haugen, quote, wants to fix Facebook, not burn it to the ground, unquote. Haugen got a handsome book deal after her testimony, and billionaire Pierre Omidyar, the founder of eBay, offered her the free services of his public relations firm. That's a pretty nice outcome if you're Frances Haugen. Twitter whistleblower Peter Zatko had a similar experience. Known as Mudge, Zatko was a highly respected hacker who eventually found his way to employment at DARPA. That's the Defense Department's super secret Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. From there, he went to Twitter as the Director of Information Security, but he was forced out of the company in early 2022 after only 2 years on the job. It was 8 months later that Mudge went to Congress to complain that Twitter was deficient in its handling of user information and spam bots. He added that Twitter made false representations to billionaire Elon Musk, who at the time was in the process of trying to buy the company. Mudge received a buyout from Twitter that paid him $7 million. A gag order was attached to the settlement, except where it concerned congressional testimony. So everybody's happy. Mudge gets to make his revelations, he gets to keep his $7 million, and Twitter says they've already implemented his recommendations. They get to call him a disgruntled ex-employee. How do we tell a real whistleblower from a fake one? How do we tell the difference between somebody who's jeopardizing everything from one who's trying to cash in? We're joined by Lewis Clark. He's the CEO and executive director of the Government Accountability Project. Lewis, thank you so much for joining us. Let's start with that most basic of questions. How can you tell the difference between a real whistleblower and somebody who is trying to cash in or maybe make a name for themselves?
For one thing, is that sort of assumes that motive is so important. And I think that what we focus on when a whistleblower comes in our doors is whether they have what they have to say in terms of the truth of the matter, what they're presenting. The law, you know, or at least most laws protecting whistleblowers, what's key is, do these people have a reasonable belief that what they're saying is right? And so we focus on, are they right about what they're saying? And then if they are, then we try to do something about it. The problem with motive is you don't always know what it's sometimes absolutely impossible to know what someone's motive might be. And I can't think of many cases that we've presented or many cases that we've taken and advocacy that we've, you know, gone forth with, where the other side doesn't say something really negative about the motive of the person. You know, they're a disgruntled employee, or they just want to make money. I'd say just want to make money is probably one of the most common representations that our opponents say about the whistleblower. So I don't think that you need to focus on the whistleblower. What we focus on is the wrongdoing that the whistleblower presents.
Just as an aside, when I first blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program, the Government Accountability Project leapt to my defense. And one of the things that I learned very early on was that motivation really was irrelevant. My attorney at the time, my GAP attorney, told me that that she wasn't going to focus at all on motivation, that the key was exactly what you just said it is the information correct? Is the information true? And then we just moved on from there.
Yeah, because what you need to focus on is the wrongdoing. What the other side often does is they want to pick apart or try to find some kind of skeleton in the closet or whatever, so that the focus is on the whistleblower. And if you focus on the whistleblower and what motivates the whistleblower, then you can then not have to worry about what the whistleblower has to say. Well, that's not our approach. We put on trial the company or the organization, not the whistleblower.
Not only are you the CEO and executive director of the Government Accountability Project, but you also helped to launch it. GAP is now the most important whistleblower protection organization in America. GAP represented me, as I said a moment ago, after I blew the whistle on the CIA's torture program. I know that you're inundated day in and day out by people seeking GAP's help. A lot of people consider themselves to be whistleblowers and they're looking for somewhere to turn. How do you begin to wade through the information to separate the real from maybe the not so real, or the cases that require immediate attention from those that that don't?
Well, of course you have to immediately examine the evidence. So you look at both the truth of what they have to say, and you also look at the credibility of the person coming forward. In many ways, it's almost like your heart, if you're hiring someone for your organization, you want to make sure that they're credible, they're honest, et cetera. So you sort of investigate them in the sense of their credibility, which you can establish by just looking at their record. I mean, they've got outstanding performance appraisals for 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, that's common. And so you know that they're really good employees, and their credibility is usually established that way as well as talking to peers, talking to people who know them, in a way that's obviously confidential. But you can find out from, you know, obviously peers, what a person's reputation might be. So you do that. That's just due diligence. And also a very important factor for the people that come to our organization is how important it is. And unfortunately, many people we turn away just because, yes, it's whistleblowing, but it's not significant enough for us to be engaged because we have limited resources. Mm-hmm. And so we do have to focus on the cases that are going to be more in the public interest, and certainly as you suggested, immediate concern, so that someone's going to really be hurt if we don't step forward and try to deal with what these whistleblowers are saying, some danger, public health safety danger, for example.
I mentioned in an earlier episode of the show that an Israeli journalist by the name of Eyal Press published a book called Beautiful Souls, which is a psychological look at four whistleblowers in modern history. He found that whistleblowers as a group tend to have a very highly defined sense of right and wrong, far more well-defined than the general population. Whistleblowers tend to see things in terms of black and white rather than shades of gray. And they're willing to make their revelations without concern for their personal well-being. Is that your experience with some of these better-known corporate whistleblowers as well? Are they different than national security whistleblowers, let's say?
Oh, boy. No, I don't. I think that they're the same in our experience. But where I would, I love Eyal Press. He's a good friend, actually. If there's a suggestion in his description that things are actually gray, then I have a problem with it, because there's sort of an assumption there that everything's gray and the whistleblowers are somehow seeing black and white when things are gray. And I actually don't see it that way. What I see is whistleblowers do have a keen sense of personal responsibility, a keen sense of essentially taxpayer sensibility, mm-hmm. or the sensibility of people, you know, consumers, et cetera. I mean, I do think it's true. They see things in black and white, but you know, when's torture ever good? You know, when's torture ever acceptable? I mean, you could say, oh, well, that's gray because, you know, sometimes maybe torture works, which I don't think is actually the truth. I don't think history has shown that. But let's say that torture did work. It's still bad. It's still, you know, it's still black. We still have to stop it. And so I do think that I do think they have a keen sense of morality. I also think that there's another sort of element of altruism that is also very prevalent amongst whistleblowers, which is that essentially they do have a sense of connection to people they don't know. For example, consumers, mm-hmm. taxpayers, citizens. I mean, that, you know, human beings. I mean, you know, it's like, and so, for example, there was a whistleblower on peanut butter and the salmonella contamination in the peanut butter. I mean, this man thought about his own, what the public, you know, that there are human beings out there, there are children out there that are going to be damaged by this product. And so he was moved to do something about that. And I do think that's very real for whistleblowers. They have a sense of connection to the larger community or the larger society, which is often absent in all those thousands of employees that see the same thing and don't do anything about it. And so I think that really they really stand apart in that sense. I also think there's another element too that I would bring up, which is essentially is that there's a huge percent of whistleblowers who are, they never intended to be whistleblowers. All they're doing is their job. And right. they're doing their job when the company or the government agency really doesn't want them to do that job.
Right.
You know, they really don't want, they really are off the mission of the organization. And they're, engaged in wrongdoing, engaged in corruption. And so the person, you know, whose job it is to audit that problem or audit the agency or have compliance with the regulations or the rules of the organization, that all of a sudden the agency or the company doesn't want you to follow those rules, even though they're basic to the enterprise.
Thank you, Lewis Clark. Stay tuned. We're going to take a short break and come back for more with Lewis Clark, the CEO and Executive Director of the Whistleblower Protection Organization Government Accountability Project.
Is your media a reflection of reality? In a world transformed, what will make you feel safer? Isolation or community? Are you going the right way or are you being led somewhere? Which direction? What is truth? What is fake? In a world corrupted, you need to descend. So join us in the depths or remain in the shallows.
Русофобия оказалась выгодным бизнесом.
Они Украину предали, ограбили и отдали на растерзание американцев. Украину, мою родину.
Эти люди готовились достаточно открыто. Финансирование проводилось достаточно широко, и мы знаем всех акторов, кто это финансирование получал.
8 лет двигались ровно в этом направлении, чтобы вот расчеловечить русских и разорвать все связи.
Это результат серьезной работы над историческим сознанием.
Преступление против человечества задокументированных на украинских территориях очень много. И большая часть из них совершена при попустительстве или по прямому приказу нынешнего или прошлого киевского руководства.
Уже они давно вышли из легального поля, давно, значит, действуют другими методами, неконституционными.
Это и есть преступление по нацистскому образцу.
Unit 731 was a unique organization in the history of the world. What they were trying to do was to simply do nothing short than build the most powerful and most deadly biological weapons program that the world had ever known.
お母さんも殺してな。重要歳の子供ですからね、まだ、やっぱり病気にかかった人、怪我をした人、こういった人の治療をやったりすると思ってたんです。ところが、しまいにはね、細菌性の、専門技術になるというようなことが出てきましたけれども。
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. We're speaking with Lewis Clark. He's CEO and executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Government Accountability Project. We're talking about why some whistleblowers are vilified while others are celebrated, even enriched, for their whistleblowing. You've helped whistleblowers from every walk of life since 1978. Are there differences in whistleblowing depending on industry or on whether a person is in government or in the private sector? Do whistleblowers in these two different areas approach their whistleblowing differently?
Yeah, I think there are differences. For example, if you're talking about government, then essentially the employer is really the American people, right? You know, or the citizens, the voters, whatever. I mean, the fact of the matter is they have a constituency of the country. The sovereign is the people. And so therefore in government, you pretty much have a direct line. And also, of course, the oath of office that you mentioned is another, you know, absolutely paramount standard that many, including yourself, were following in your whistleblowing. And so therefore, that has a higher standard. In the private sector, you have to deal with the idea of profit.
Right.
And so in that regard, you know, maybe you get gray in the sense that the company itself has a duty to stock, you know, shareholders. But wait a minute. What if that means that you had cut corners in terms of the nuclear industry, for example? It costs more to be, you know, to essentially secure safety or establish safety or maintain safety. And you might want to cut some corners in order to make more money, in order to make shareholders happier. So in a sense, you do end up having a obligation to be a part of an organization that's making money for shareholders. At the same time, you have public responsibility and social responsibility as a corporation. Which also plays into this the thinking of a whistleblower, and so we do address it in that sense a little bit differently. I mean, how we would say it is that basically it's never helpful. Essentially, if you look at, you know, ethics is good business is often said in the corporate world. Well, ethics is ethics. It might be bad business. but it's ethical, right. And that's the standard. And so you do get some ambiguity in the private sector that you don't get in the public, as much as you would in the public sphere.
And in your experience, have you encountered whistleblowers who, when they blew the whistle, their parent company or parent governmental agency, rather than attacking them or trying to silence them, said, "Oh my goodness, we didn't realize this was going on. This is a serious issue. We're going to have to fix this right away." Is that common? Is it rare? What's your experience?
Unfortunately, I think it's rare, but I do think it. But it does happen, and in fact, in every organization, there are a lot of people who have blown the whistle and they've continued up the ladder. It's just that, you know, that they got away with it in a way, perhaps, or they were more effective in how they pulled it off. But the fact of the matter is it's too infrequent. Mm. But I think increasingly, companies are realizing the value of whistleblowing.
Good. I recently read an interview that you did in which you talked about how necessary whistleblowers are in all walks of life. A toy company, for example, imported toys from China that were painted with lead paint, which we know, when ingested, can lead to brain damage in children. You talked about defense contractors in Iraq padding their expenses to essentially steal money from the American taxpayers. That's sort of an old story. That goes on all the time. You talked about a pharmaceutical company making vaccines for children despite having a compromised quality control system. The problems seem to just never end. And as a result, we need more and more whistleblowers. Are you optimistic or pessimistic about the trajectory of things? Is it getting easier for whistleblowers to make their revelations, or is it becoming more difficult?
No, I do think it's becoming easier. I mean, there was a Marist poll last year of whistleblower, the attitude of the American public, you know, voters, about whistleblowing, and 86% of the population of this country say that they're in support of strong whistleblower protections. Well, that was not true 40 years ago. Wow. That certainly wasn't even true when you blew the whistle so effectively and so incredibly, actually.
Oh, thank you.
No, that wasn't true. It's certainly become recognized as an important part of having an effective government and also having essentially corporations that adhere to the law.
Lewis, you've seen pretty much everything there is to see in the world of whistleblowing. What advice would you give to somebody considering blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality? Is there a way to do it safely to protect oneself?
There's probably not too many ways that you can do it to totally protect yourself. I mean, even leaking information, you know, can be identified to a person. So it's never completely safe, but I would say that the first thing someone should do is to find help before they start the process of blowing the whistle. Now, obviously, someone who's caught up in the job and is just doing their job and the company doesn't or the agency does not want them to do their job, then it might be too late. But for the, for many whistleblowers, if they would seek counsel, experienced counsel, and counsel that's not going to say, don't do that, but it should be the counsel that says, okay, you want this to be dealt with. Let's do it effectively, and let's think about the best way to do it. And so you develop a strategy before you actually go public or go, let's say, within the company itself.
I would actually like to reiterate that. People ask me all the time if I would do something differently if I were to sort of relive my own experience. And I say the same thing every time. I would have sought out legal advice before blowing the whistle. Instead, I just blew the whistle and then I came to Gap. I was reactive. instead of being proactive. So my own advice is the same as yours. If a person is considering blowing the whistle, they really need to speak to an attorney who specializes in whistleblowing first, and to try to protect himself or herself.
Yeah, we have a number of clients who have blown the whistle for years, for example, at the Department of Homeland Security. And it's unbelievable how much they've been able to accomplish, even though they were on 60 Minutes and even though they had New York Times articles. But the way that we approached it and the way that we had their back, and not only ourselves, but many members of Congress and several committees of Congress had their back, so they couldn't be touched. And so that we do work on trying to get as much support for the whistleblower before the whistleblower is endangered.
Thank you, Lewis. That's all we have for you today. I'd like to thank our guest, Lewis Clark. He's CEO and Executive Director of the Government Accountability Project. I'm John Kiriakou, and this has been The Whistleblowers.